Welcome to today's podcast. It's good to be with you. You remember last time we met, we talked a little bit about Joseph of Egypt. And today we're going to follow up with another Egypt prophet, Moses. The account of God, or Jehovah, delivering the children of Egypt out of bondage by a shepherd from Midian is one of the most important biblical events ever recorded. It is the most often mentioned event in the Old Testament, referred to over 120 times. In addition, there are numerous subsequent laws and celebrations that have gone unbroken for over 3,500 years, such as Passover. Yet, there is no evidence that the Exodus event ever happened. Listen to these learned men. The book of Joshua is of no historical value as far as the process of settlement is concerned, contends Volkmar Fritz, director of the German Protestant Institute of Archaeology in Jerusalem. The period of the patriarchs, Exodus, conquest, or judges, as devised by the writers of Scripture, never existed, declares Robert Coate of the San Francisco Theological Seminary. The Genesis and Exodus account are a fiction written around the middle of the first millennium, states Niels Peter Lamech at the University of Copenhagen. Well, lest we go farther. If this is just reading fiction, I guess we should just stop. The Hebrew name for the book Exodus is Velech Shemoth. It is taken from the first two words of the Hebrew text in the book. It translates, and these are the names. This exact same phrase is actually found in Genesis 46:8, listing the names of those who went down to Egypt. Now, this is going to infer that the book of Exodus was probably not intended to be a standalone book, and that Genesis was to be much larger than it is today. At some point after Moses had written the composition, a compiler or scribe then divided out Exodus. In 1 Kings 6:1, it says, "And it came to pass in the 480th year after the children of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziph, which is the second month, that he began to build the house of the Lord." Well, we're going to be talking extensively about this number, 1446 B.C. This would put the Exodus and the events surrounding it around 1446 B.C. It would also place the Exodus under the reign of Pharaoh Amenhotep II. Now, I know I'm getting ahead of myself, but I want to establish a foundation for some archaeological evidence that will support our story of the Exodus. Now, Amenhotep II was reigning during the Exodus event during the 1450s. He is known to have spent considerable time in the Delta region in a palace in Avaris. This is the same Avaris of the Hyksos kings of the Joseph of Egypt era, some 250 years earlier. And we talked extensively about Avaris in our last podcast. According to Egyptologist Charles Ayling, Amenhotep II was born and raised in the area. Now, if you compare the military campaigns of Amenhotep II with those of Dad, his father, Thutmose III, there's a really interesting, odd mystery. Dad, Thutmose III, is depicted on the slide here, led 17 military campaigns into the Levant. Now, the Levant, again, is that area between Egypt and Syria. He boasted of having taken 5,903 captives on his first campaign. Now, Amenhotep II led only two military campaigns that we can identify. On his last campaign, in the ninth year of his reign, around, again, 1446 BC, it appears that he threw together a hasty and limited excursion into Palestine, and he took captive 101,128 slaves. Now, one explanation for this campaign is that Amenhotep II was trying to replace a large portion of his slave labor base that has just taken a long-awaited leave of absence. Another footnote to Amenhotep II is that his firstborn son did not become the next pharaoh of Egypt. In fact, Amenhotep II was not the firstborn son of Thutmose III. It seems that for some reason, firstborn sons were short-lived during this particular era, i.e. perhaps the 10th plague. Well, we've now established a tentative time frame and a pharaoh. With this introduction, let's go ahead and explore the book of Exodus. Joseph of Egypt lived another 54 years after his father Jacob's death. He lived to see great-grandchildren by both Manasseh and Ephraim. He died at the age of 110, which was considered by the Egyptians to be the ideal age. In Exodus 1:8, it says, "Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph." Well, the Hyksos, Semitic shepherd kings, were overthrown by the native Hamitic pharaohs during the second intermediate period. Avaris fell in 1521 BC, fell to Amus, that's the picture that we have here, founder of the 18th dynasty, thereby ending about 108 years of Hyksos rule over Egypt. And of course, Joseph of Egypt was there during Hyksos kings. The Israelites, the scriptures say, are more mighty than the Egyptians. Therefore, they were put in bondage and forced to build the storage cities, or the treasure cities of Pithom and Ramses. Pharaoh's decision to limit the population of the Israelite people by infanticide was akin to Herod's edict in the New Testament. Now, this picture portrays the Egyptians throwing the Semitic children of Israel, into the Nile River, and the crocodiles are there. In Matthew 2:16, it says, "Then Herod, when he saw that he was mocked by the wise men, was exceedingly wroth, and sent forth and slew all the children that were in Bethlehem, and in all the coast thereof, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had diligently inquired of the wise men." Well, like Herod, could the Egyptian pharaohs also have known about the prophecies of Israel's deliverer? After all, Abraham knew, Jacob knew, Joseph knew his name, Moses. Well, since these patriarchs taught much to the Egyptians, perhaps they knew and decided to initiate a preemptive strike, kill the male children. But you know the story. Moses lived, and Moses was a pure Levite. In Moses 6, verses 19 and 20, it says, "These are the families of Levi according to their generations. And Amram took him Jochebed, his father's sister, to wife, and she bare him Aaron and Moses." Well, Moses was a goodly child. In Exodus 2:2, it says that. And Elder Bruce R. McConkie provides us with some fascinating insight to Moses. He says, "Moses was in the similitude of Christ, and Christ was likened to Moses. All men are created in the image of God, but it appears that there is a special image, a special similitude, a special likeness where the man Moses and the man Jesus are concerned. That is to say, Moses bore the resemblance of his Lord." Well, in appearance, guise, and semblance, they were the same. The qualities of the one were the qualities of the other. From the book, verse by verse, of the Old Testament by Ogden and Skinner, the following comparison is made of Moses and Jesus Christ. Both Jesus and Moses survived attempts of infanticide. Both were saved by their families. Both were tempted by Satan face to face. Both were foreordained. Both provided manna from heaven, Moses the physical food, and Christ the living manna, the bread of life. Both viewed the lands and kingdoms of the earth. Both were humble and meek above all men. Both controlled the water and the earth. Moses was the mediator of the Old Testament, Christ the mediator of the New Testament. Well, after Moses took a life to save a life, he flees Egypt, and he puts his face towards Midian. Now, why Midian? According to Genesis, the ancestry of the tribe of the Midianites is none other than a son of Abraham. After Hagar was banished and Sarah died, Abraham took Keturah to wife. Now, Keturah bore 6 sons. One of those sons is Midian, father of the Midianites. So Moses fled to common ground, a place he knew that the ancestry of the patriarchs were living. In Midian, Moses finds the 2 most important things in his life, First of all, Zipporah, his wife. And second, the priesthood at the hands of his father-in-law, Jethro. In Doctrine and Covenants, section 84, verses 6 and 7, it says, "And the sons of Moses, according to the holy priesthood, which he received under the hand of his father-in-law, Jethro. And Jethro received it under the hand of Caleb." Well, through inspiration, the Lord leads Moses to God's mountain. God's mountain is called Horeb, or Sinai. Here he sees a burning bush, is confronted by a messenger, and hears the voice of God. In the Joseph Smith translation of Genesis chapter 3, verse 2, it says, "And again the presence of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire in the midst of the bush. And he looked, and beheld the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed." Well, with Moses standing in the presence of the Lord, he was transfigured so as not to be consumed. And he asked the Lord a question. What was he to say if the people that he were to rescue asked him, "Who sent you? What was his name?" Well, Moses is told that the Lord's name, as known to the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, was Jehovah. In Exodus chapter 6, verse 3, it says, "And I appeared unto Abraham, and unto Isaac, and unto Jacob, by the name of God Almighty. But by my name Jehovah was I not known to them." Oh, we need a correction of this particular verse. Reading the Joseph Smith translation of the same verse, Joseph Smith added a question mark to the end of the verse. And it says, "But by my name Jehovah was I not known to them?" This simple punctuation clears up the name of the Lord. In Hebrew, the name Jehovah is derived from the verb I am. Many scholars believe that the most proper meaning of the word would be, the word of Jehovah would be, "He brings into existence whatever exists." Moses continues his stalling, knowing the Lord's name is good, but what if these people he's to rescue ask for a sign? Well, the Lord is patient with Moses and shows him that his rod can turn into a serpent and a serpent back to a rod. He also shows him that his hand can be leprous and his hand can be clean. Well, there's one more issue with Moses. He is like Enoch. Moses is slow of speech. He says, "I am slow of speech and I have a slow tongue." And so now we have the beginning of the calling of Aaron. In Exodus 7:1, Joseph Smith translation, "And the Lord said unto Moses, See, I have made thee a prophet to Pharaoh, and Aaron thy brother shall be thy spokesman." Well, bring on Pharaoh. But we got to make a clarification or two. In Exodus 7:3, it says, "And I will harden Pharaoh's heart and multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt." Well, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And that particular phrase, "I will harden Pharaoh's heart," is found on numerous times as we go through these various miracles. Well, let's read that verse from the Joseph Smith translation, Exodus 7:3. "And Pharaoh will harden his heart, as I said unto thee, and thou shalt multiply my signs." So we got to make sure that as you read through Exodus, you change in your mind this particular phrase. Pharaoh is going to harden his own heart here. Okay? But Moses begins with the rod to the serpent miracle. But Pharaoh's magicians do the same thing. Now, why were they able to match the things that Moses was doing? Well, the answer to that question is found in Doctrine and Covenants, section 63, verse 7, and it says, "And he that seeketh a sign shall see signs, but not signs unto salvation." There's a difference here. Well, now the onslaught of miracles. Plague 1, the Nile. All streams, rivers, ponds, pools of water, all water in vessels of wood, all water in stones turned to blood. And the magicians of Egypt did so with their enchantments. If all water was turned to blood, I find it difficult to understand where the magicians were able to also show this miracle happening. Nevertheless, it says they did. Well, the Nile does sometimes turn red, either because of red soil deposits or a mixture of algae and bacteria in the water. Plague 2. Frogs shall go up into thine house, into thy bedchamber, upon thy bed, into the house of the servants, upon the people, into the ovens, and into the kneading troughs. And the magicians did so too, with their enchantments, and they brought forth frogs. That is a lot of frogs. Well, when the Nile turns red, it becomes toxic. All the animals that depend on the Nile flee inland in search of water. And that might explain why frogs are suddenly covering the land. Plague 3. And they gathered together the frogs upon heaps, and the land stank. And now we have lice. Lice everywhere. The dust of the earth becomes lice in man and beast. And the magicians did so with their enchantments to bring forth lice, but they could not. This ends the copycat magician effort. They're not able to do anything from this point further. So the first two plagues, apparently they did something akin to what Moses did, but from this point on, they do not. Plague 4, swarms of flies. Flies upon the servants, upon the people, in the houses. And this is interesting, but no flies in the land of Goshen where the Lord's people dwelt. So now we have a protective bubble over Goshen, and they're not going to suffer the plagues from this point on. Pharaoh at this point calls Moses and Aaron in and says, go ye and sacrifice to your God in the land. But he'll harden his heart, as he does many times. With piles of dead fish and frogs everywhere, the outbreak of disease carried by the lice and the flies is inevitable. And that is the pestilence that the fifth plague now talks about. Plague 5, livestock pestilence. The pestilence was upon the cattle in the field, upon the horses, upon the asses, upon the camels, upon the oxen, and upon the sheep. And then plague 6. With the animals now infected, the disease spreads to the humans in form of boils. Boils break out with blains. Now, what are blains? Blains are pus-filled lesions or blisters on the surface of the skin. They come forth on both man and beast. And the magicians could not stand before Moses because of their boils. Plague 7. Now, this particular plague kind of changes its focus. Instead of the Nile region, it's going to affect the climate of Egypt. So there was hail and fire mingled with hail, very grievous, such as there was none like it in all the land of Egypt. And the hail smote the fields, both man and beast. It smote every herb, and it broke every tree. Only in the land of Goshen was there no hail. Again, Pharaoh calls Moses in and says, go. And again, Pharaoh's going to harden his heart. Plague 8, locusts. Locusts were everywhere. They were so many locusts that you could not see the earth you were standing on. All you saw was moving ground of locusts. The pestilence of locusts, perhaps the moisture in the air, encouraged the breeding of insects, and that may have affected why there was perhaps so much locusts. In May of 2020, a huge swarm of locusts devastated East Africa, destroying as much as 300 million pounds of crops in a single day, the equivalent of food for 35,000 people per year. The locusts even attacked infants and children. And let us not forget the miracle of the gulls, when in 1848, the seagulls rescued the pioneer harvest by eating thousands upon thousands of invading locusts. I especially like the comments made by Pharaoh's servants and magicians at this particular point in time. In Exodus 10:7, they say, and Pharaoh's servants said unto him, how long shall this man be a snare to us? Let the men go, that they may serve the Lord their God. Knowest thou not yet that Egypt is destroyed? Love that. Plague 9, darkness over the land for 3 days. The uniqueness of this darkness was that it could be felt. Even darkness over the land of Egypt, even darkness which may be felt. But all the children of Israel had light in their dwellings. In 3 Nephi chapter 8, verses 20 and 23, it says, and it came to pass there was thick darkness over all the face of the land, insomuch that the inhabitants thereof who had not fallen could feel the vapor of darkness. And it came to pass that it did last for the space of 3 days, that there was no light. And there was great mourning and howling and weeping among all the people continually. Yea, great were the groanings of the people because of the darkness and the great destruction which had come upon them. Well, this sounds vaguely familiar. In Exodus chapter 10, verses 28 and 29, it says, "And Pharaoh said unto him, Get thee from me, take heed to thyself, see my face no more. For in that day that thou seest my face, thou shalt die." And Moses said, "Thou hast spoken well. I will see thy face again no more." Well, with that remark, Pharaoh sealed his fate. The firstborn in all the land of Egypt will die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh, even to the firstborn of the maidservant and the firstborn of the beast. Israel would be spared the tenth plague by participating in the ordinance of Passover. Instructions concerning the sacrificial lamb were given. The lamb, of course, representing the atoning sacrifice of Jesus Christ, which would come. Unleavened bread was to be prepared. This represented the haste of the Israelites as they prepared for their departure, and it was to be eaten for 7 days. The lamb was to be slaughtered on the 14th day of the month of Aviv and continue through the 21st of that month. Now, those dates have become what we call fixed Sabbaths to be observed every year. Jewish families today still celebrate and revere this particular part of their history and express their love for freedom to their children. In Exodus chapter 12, verse 33 of the Joseph Smith translation, it says, "We have found our firstborn all dead. Therefore get ye out of the land, lest we die also." Well, the Israelites left with the treasures of Egypt, and there were a great mixed multitude that went forth. It's safe to conclude that non-Israelites, as well as some Egyptians perhaps, went with Moses. The Exodus began with 600,000 men besides women and children. In Exodus 12:37, the Joseph Smith translation says, "And the children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, besides women and children." That's an awful lot of people. 600,000 men, plus their wives and some children, that's probably over 1 million people. My personal number for the exiting Israelites is the number of slaves rounded up by Amenhotep II, that 101,128. Whatever your number is, there were a lot of people exiting Egypt, and only the Lord could help them survive in the desolate terrain of the Sinai Peninsula, which is where they're headed. In Exodus chapter 13, we are introduced to a rather unique custom practiced by conservative Jews today. Exodus 13, verses 9 and 16 say, "And it shall be for a sign unto thee upon thine hand, and for a memorial between thine eyes, that the Lord's law may be in thy mouth. For with a strong hand hath the Lord brought thee out of Egypt. And it shall be for a token upon thine hand, and for frontlets between thine eyes. For by strength of the hand of the Lord brought us out of Egypt." Well, the sign or token, referred to as frontlets, are these small little leather boxes worn on the arm, left arm, to be next to the heart, and also worn on the forehead between the eyes to be next to the mind. Inside these little leather boxes are four small pieces of parchment that are handwritten with text taken from Exodus and Deuteronomy. Two from Exodus, Exodus 13, 1 through 10, and Exodus 13, 11 through 16, and Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 9, and chapter 11, verses 12 through 21. These frontlets are referred to as tefillin, or phylacteries in Greek. They are worn to maintain a continuous sign of remembrance of the blessings the Israelites received in their exodus from Egypt. Now, there's one final task for the Israelites prior to leaving Egypt. In Exodus 13:19, it says, "And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he," Moses, excuse me, it's not correct, it's Joseph, sorry. Mm-hmm. There's one final task for the Israelites prior to departing Egypt. In Exodus 13:19, it says, "And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he," Joseph, our Joseph of Egypt, "he had straitly sworn the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and ye shall carry up my bones away hence with you." Well, our story of Egypt, its land of mystery and intrigue, is concluded. It's no wonder the Egyptians wanted to to have no trace of Joseph of Egypt or Moses left on any wall, any tomb, or any stelae. The walls, the tombs, and the stelae are for Egyptian success stories, not for failures. Nevertheless, there is some circumstantial archaeological evidence that the nation of Israel did exist, and I want to now take some time and share some of that with you. Some have suggested that Moses did not write the first five books of the Bible because there was no alphabet, and there was no alphabetic script at the time for Moses to use. Well, in the early 20th century, Sir Flinders Petrie found inscribed stones at an Egyptian turquoise mine in the Sinai. They date between 1900 and 1500 BC. They are called the Proto-Sinaitic script. Now, this script was invented by the Semitic people who worked the mines and adopted the Egyptian hieroglyphic symbols. This language is from Canaan. Douglas Petrovich has presented evidence that these inscriptions were written by Israelites and that the Hebrew language is behind the script. His translation of one particular inscription, Sinai 361, as shown on your slide, contains the name of Moses. It is interesting that a writing script was developed at the very time that the Israelites were in Egypt and that its place of origin seems to be Canaan. Next, there are many Egyptian words found in Hebrew text. Egyptologist James Hoffmeyer has highlighted the numerous Egyptian words often used in Hebrew. These Egyptian loan words, as we call them, found in Hebrew text, are difficult to explain unless you acknowledge the fact that Moses had an Egyptian education and was the author of the book of Exodus. Now, many scholars don't even believe that the Israelites were ever in Egypt. Now, there's evidence, however, that the Israelites were in Egypt. We call it the Papyrus Brooklyn 35.1446 document. It was written in Herodic text. This piece of papyrus names 95 household servants of a noblewoman by the name of Senetsi. 40 names are Semitic, and several have been identified as Hebrew names. This papyrus dates to the time of all things Joseph of Egypt, prior to the Exodus. This list clearly identifies Hebrew people living in Egypt. We have found tomb paintings depicting slaves making bricks. In the tomb of Rechmeyer, the vizier of Egypt under Thutmose III and Amenhotep II, are found paintings of Nubian and Asiatic slaves making bricks for the Karnak Temple. The Egyptians called the people from Canaan Asiatics. They are the light-colored people, as you see on the slide. The paintings show the slaves collecting, mixing mud and water, packing the mud into brick molds, and leaving them to dry in the sun. This affirms the biblical description of the process of making bricks and the fact that Asiatics were doing the making. At the end of the 15th century, the pharaoh Amenhotep III built a temple to honor the god Amun-Ra at Soleb. Now, Soleb's in Nubia, which is modern-day northern Sudan today. He made a list called the Soleb Inscription. It detailed all the territories that Amenhotep III claimed to have conquered, and one of these territories is identified as the land of Shasu of Yahweh. This is the land of the Canaanites. The prisoner, as depicted on the left, clearly portrays a Semitic rather than an African individual. The inscription clearly references Yahweh in the Egyptian hieroglyphics. This is the oldest such reference outside of the Bible. It is obvious that Amenhotep III in 1400 BC knew about the God of Yahweh. And this does two things for us. First of all, Pharaoh, Amenhotep III, knew about Moses as God, and that knowledge he had was attained prior to 1400 BC. Now remember our Exodus date of 1446 BC. The Berlin pedestal is an Egyptian inscription in the Egyptian Museum in Berlin that most certainly references Israel as a nation in Canaan. It has three rings similar to cartouches with names on it. One reads Ashkelon, that's the far left one. The middle one reads Canaan, and the third one, Israel. These three names appear to have been written during the reign of none other than Amenhotep II, our Pharaoh of the Exodus. And it is the oldest reference to Israel ever found. Lastly, let me reference the Merneptah Stela. Perhaps the most important discovery related to Moses in the Exodus is the Merneptah Stele. In 1208 BC, Pharaoh Merneptah erected a 10-foot-tall victory stele. It boasted of his military victories over both Libya and Canaan. This monument was discovered in 1896 by our friend Sir Flinder Petrie. Now, Petrie was also the one that discovered the proto-Sinaitic inscriptions, our alphabet that we discussed earlier. On the stele, Merneptah boasts, "Israel is wasted, its seed is not, and Canaan is become a widow because of Egypt." Well, most scholars agree that this is one of the oldest definitive references to Israel as a nation outside of the Bible itself. It's certainly the clearest Egyptian reference to the nation of Israel. Well, although perhaps not conclusive, our circumstantial evidence certainly leads to supporting the Exodus from Egypt story. Israelites were slaves in Egypt. They left suddenly and settled in Canaan eventually by the end of the 15th century as a nation. It also points out to the fact that the Pharaoh who knew not Joseph, these individuals were quick to eliminate all references to both Joseph and Moses, two Semitic men, one who saved Egypt and one who walked out of Egypt. Both ultimately successful with what they did, and both unintentionally disgraced a proud Egypt. I want to thank you today for joining me. I hope you found our material interesting. The next time we meet, our next podcast will cover Exodus chapters 14 through 17, as well as a special presentation that I have on the atonement for Easter. Thanks again.